Morning. Call to order this hearing of the Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes, Tuesday, March 3rd, 2015. Do we have a quorum? We are going to take two bills dealing with the same subject up first, and then we'll have the testimony. Since they deal with the same subject, I hope that's agreeable to the authors. Senator Peterson?
It is.
That's right. Yep.
Okay. Senator Franzen, you have the lower number. Why don't you start?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee Members. Good morning. This is Senate File 190, which provides for a sales tax exemption to cover physical bullion purchases. I also have author's amendment, so I'm not sure if the committee wants to move it first because it will be in the shape that I like to move it.
Yes, what we will do, if you have amendments, either one of you, we will put them on as you present your bills, and then after we have the testimony, then we'll lay them over as amended.
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Senator Franzen, do you have an amendment?
I do.
There you go.
And it's the A1 amendment.
Senator Thompson moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Let's see. Can we move on things without a quorum?
Coonan did stop by though. Coonan was just outside here.
Okay, so I have a quorum.
I recall.
The committee administrator says we have a quorum. So Senator Thompson moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Franzen, the summary is drawn to the bill as amended. So why don't you explain that, and then we will go on to Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I can't do a better job than the summary that was done by our staff, so thank you for that. I'd just like to comment on what the bill will do and the benefits of passing this tax exemption. So I'll just give a brief summary of a couple of justifications for the bill. First, this has a negative impact on consumers in Minnesota who wish to purchase precious metals for investments or to balance their portfolio. Already, 31 other states, including Iowa and the Dakotas, have exempted precious metal bullion from taxation, and three others are considering it. Most Minnesotans who currently purchase precious metals are doing so in tax-exempt states, so the incoming tax revenue impact to Minnesota is very small. If you're a consumer, you lose about 7.25% on your investment right at the time of purchase because of our current tax system. And why would a consumer purchase here in Minnesota if that's initially what they're going to be losing? Secondly, because the sales tax provides a disincentive for Minnesotans to buy locally, consumers are more likely to be defrauded by unscrupulous firms who either upsell, bait and switch, or simply do not deliver their product to consumers. And as you may recall, 2 years ago, the legislature passed a bill to regulate Minnesota dealers. It is much easier for the Department of Commerce to regulate local dealers than to chase out-of-state dealers. And with this bill, consumers will have the opportunity to shop local, build a relationship with their dealer, and keep revenue in Minnesota, which helps our economy. And I have with me today Mr. Gary Atkins, who will provide further testimony. But if you'd like to hear from
Senator.
We're
going to hear the other bill first. Sure. And just point out, as we are looking at both of these, we've had similar proposals in the past that did not, in the Senate, didn't make it to the omnibus tax bill. It did in the House, but then it didn't survive the conference committee, and the one of the issues was the issue of rarity with regard to the value. So that's, I think, with your A1 amendment that deals with that. Is that what you would say, Ms. Pollack?
Madam Chair and members, yes, the A1 amendment was drafted to make the definition of bullion based on the weight and the value of the metal alone, not on the rarity of the piece of metal, such as a coin.
And Ms. Pollack, is the revenue note drawn to the bill as amended?
Madam Chair, for Senate File 190, no, the revenue estimate is drawn to the bill as introduced.
And Ms. McQuaid, did she indicate that there would be less of an impact on the general fund and legacy funds, or more anticipated?
Madam Chair and members, I did have a conversation very briefly with Revenue regarding the amendment, and they were beginning to look into that this morning. And I think the intention of the amendment is to narrow what this sales tax exemption applies to, and I think that will be reflected in the revenue estimate.
Okay. Just want to make sure everybody understands that. any questions on from the members before we hear from Senator Peterson? Okay, we're just going to set it aside for right now. Your bill will come back later to have a motion regarding it. Senator Peterson, you have Senate File 544.
Thank you,
Madam. Explain how it's different or what? And,
sure.
And I actually value your opinion on the amendment that was just offered.
Yeah, thank
actually,
you.
I had it on the floor with me yesterday, and I had hoped that I could find you to share it with you then. So I'm sorry if this morning was the first time you'd seen it. But Senator Peterson, Senate File 544.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to the amendment, it's a good amendment. I think it's in keeping with the spirit of the bill, which is that these items are not consumer goods or services, but rather investment items used a lot of times as a hedge, as a part of a portfolio against inflation and other things. So I would encourage the committee in a future bill, if you address this issue, that the A1 amendment is good language from my standpoint. The only difference between the bill is mine as bullion and bullion coin. I think the objective is the same, though. It doesn't make sense to tax precious metals as a consumer good and a sales tax when it's really an investment item, and we have a tax mechanism already to tax capital gains and things of that nature. So I don't think I need to say much more than that.
Sure. Ms. Pollack, why is the or maybe Ms. McQuaid has to come back. The bills is introduced. What accounts for the difference in revenue estimate?
I think it was, Madam Chair, it was $1.37 million, I think is what I got from revenue, and I don't have it with me.
You don't have the revenue estimate?
I don't have it with me, but it was $1.37 million in the next biennium. I know that.
We'll get that to you right now. Senator Francis, do you have it?
I don't, no.
Do you have it for your own bill?
Thank you. We're trying to get the revenue estimates for the amended version. That's what we were holding up for.
We don't have that.
Yeah.
But even the difference, I'm curious about the difference in the two bills as introduced. Ms. McQuaid, what accounts for that difference?
Madam Chair and members, there is a base that they're arriving at that's slightly lower in the Franzen bill as introduced than the Peterson bill. So the Peterson bill has an estimating base of 706,000, and though the weight is more limiting, I think it includes more. The definition of bullion is a little bit wider to include a bar, ingot, or other mass, and so I think that there might be.
It's $200,000 difference. How could that be? I mean, what kind of estimating would you do that would be that far off?
Madam Chair, I can check into that specific part, but I think it has to do with the different aspects that are considered when they're investment pieces versus the rarity pieces.
Well, Senator Franzen and Senator Peterson, Senator Scoy and I are very interested in these bills. We'll hear from the testifier in a moment, but we want to make sure that absent a legislative budget office, that we have an accurate revenue estimate that reflects what's actually we would be proposing, which I am assuming will be, and certainly with your agreement, something that reflects the A1 amendment.
Do you want to ask the department?
Is it anybody here from the Mr. Cummings? We'll take care of this question first, and then we'll hear the testimony. Senator Franson, thank you. All right, Mr. Cummings can pull up a chair. That's fine. Mr. Cummings, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, I think you've been listening to the conversation. If you just kind of guide us through what happened with these revenue estimates and assure us that a revised one reflecting this A1 amendment to the Franson bill will be forthcoming.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. For the A1 amendment, there is a revenue estimate forthcoming, and okay. That will come to the committee. And as Ms. McQuay said, that there's a difference in the base between these two bills related to what is exempt, and then we can provide more analysis of that between the two bills when we provide more analysis on the A1.
And so my question would be, depending on which base we would use, given the A1 amendment, we'd get two different results. Is that correct?
I don't know the answer to that question, and I'll make sure to get it to you.
Okay. Ms. Pollack, do you have any additional information for us?
Madam Chair and members, I might just add that the base for the Senator Franzen's bill as introduced is only bullion coin, whereas Senator Peterson's includes coin plus bars and ingots and so forth that qualify with the weight requirement. However, with Senator Franzen's amendment would also include those other types of items.
I see. Probably would go to the larger base with the amendment, or the department's going to find that out for us.
Madam Chair, I, without being the fiscal analyst or speaking for the department, I'm not sure how they would come out on that. I would also just add that Senator Franzen's bill has an additional requirement that the bullion be priced as traded on a commodities market. So I don't know if that would narrow the estimate at all.
Ms. McQuay?
Madam Chair, and I would just add to what Ms. Pollack was saying, that the spot market price is something that they had possibly not considered in previous estimates, and that might help to solidify this discussion for the spot market price.
Madam Chair,
Senator Peterson.
I would just say that the spot market price language and things of that nature, I think, is good language.
Okay.
And again, I think that targets what we're both trying to get at, which is a commodities trading type use.
Okay.
So,
thank you, Mr. Cummings. Mr. Atkins, you've heard our discussion here. Why don't you comment on the bills, and also if you have anything to comment on the direction we're going and this discussion, we'd welcome that as well. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Franzen, and committee members. My name is Gary Adkins, and I'm here today on behalf of Minnesota consumers and dealers who are interested in precious metals. Just as a point of clarification, the difference between the two bills actually is that Senator Franzen's bill includes only bullion. And bullion, by definition, includes coins, bars, rounds, anything of that nature. The revision that we've asked for to the bill incorporates all of those items in the definition of bullion. The other bill, 544, also includes, by definition, collectible coins and things of that nature. So that's the main difference in the two bills. And we would be very happy, obviously, to have 544, but we were told that, you know, that we wanted to narrow the focus of this bill and keep the revenue expense of it down as much as possible, and that's so why we targeted bullion and defined bullion specifically and did not include numismatic or collectible coins in our bill. So that's the primary difference there.
Mr. Atkins, we don't do dynamic scoring in our revenue estimates, but I am curious about how you think the business climate for this industry, if you will, would change if this bill were passed. How would things be different in your estimation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it would make a huge difference to the Minnesota economy if this bill were passed exempting bullion. What it would do is create opportunities for Minnesota businesses to grow. Right now, we estimate that probably at least $50 million and maybe as much as $150 million in revenue is leaving our state to purchase precious metals in other states that have tax exemptions. So that's a big factor in our thoughts process here. It would create jobs. It would keep businesses in Minnesota. It would give consumers an opportunity to buy directly from a local source, rather than going out of the state and in order to save that 7.5% penalty, which they're paying right now. So that's a big thing to investors. If you're thinking about buying an investment in stocks or bonds and your broker told you right away that you're going to be down 7.25% right out of the gate, I think you would probably, you know, decide that wasn't a good opportunity for you. So that's our main focus here, is trying to level the playing field, give Minnesota consumers and dealers an opportunity to keep revenue in Minnesota, build the economy here, create jobs here, and I think that would go a long way to help that.
How many states currently that have a sales tax subject bullion to the sales tax?
Right now I have a map, and there's also one in your packets that shows all the various states. There are now 31 states who exempt precious metal bullion. And in some states, they also exempt numismatic or collectible coins. And all of our neighbors, Wisconsin, I think, might be considering it this year. Indiana, Virginia, Nebraska are all other states that are considering exemptions for precious metals and possibly numismatic coins. So there's quite a few states that are already doing this, and it only makes, you know, common sense to exempt them.
Thank you. questions for the authors or Mr. Atkins? Seeing none, Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to speak to the collectibles issue.
Okay.
The 544 language is as introduced. I took the House or the Senate companion from Representative Knobloch. Okay. From a tax policy standpoint, I would be fully supportive of limiting it to by weight and spot market price and eliminating the collectibles. I think it's
the rarity
it's
issue.
It's a more sound
issue for
policy,
us.
And yeah. I would agree with you on that. So I think the language that Senator Franzen has is preferable.
Is there further discussion? Then Senator Gazelka moves that Senate File 190, as amended, be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the bill will be laid over. Senator Gazelka moves that Senate File 544, with no amendments, be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is laid over. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Atkins.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. Next bill we have, Senator Dibble, is Senate File 103. Senator Dibble, is the bill the way you want it, or do you have any amendments?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. You asked if I have amendments?
I asked, yeah. Is the bill the way you want it for us to discuss, or do you have any amendments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is the way I want it.
Fine.
No amendments.
Senate File 103 is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What Senate File 103 seeks to accomplish is to exempt from sales tax materials that students would purchase, which is necessary for the completion of their instruction, with a focus on students who are seeking education on trades and arts and things like that. The reason, Madam Chair and members, that we bring this matter before you is because for some time instructional materials in the form of books and written material and the like have been exempt from sales tax. In 2001, I believe, an amendment was made to expand what would be considered to be instructional materials to include materials which were required for the completion of a course of study at a post-secondary institution, you know, whether that's a college, university, private career school, et cetera. And at the time, it is believed, and I have some evidence to that fact, and I can hand out a document that points to that.
Would you like your handout distributed?
Yeah,
the page would.
I'm going to hand out two things.
Go to Senator Dimmel.
So it was believed that materials such as art supplies or anatomical models or you know, other kinds of tools and materials that a student would need to complete their instruction to gain a degree or some sort of a certificate in a trade would be exempt. And to that end, a number of schools, and particularly the school that's represented here today by Ms. Pallava, from whom you'll hear, would sell these materials with the full understanding, at the advice of the Department of Revenue, that they obtained. They did their due diligence and wouldn't collect the sales tax. Subsequent to having sold those materials, not having collected the sales tax, it would seem that the Department of Revenue shifted how they viewed some things and asked this particular school, I don't know if other schools have had the same experience, to pay what they deemed to be a back tax liability for sales tax that went uncollected.
So this school was audited, is that what you're saying?
It was a function of an audit?
Yes.
Yeah, so yeah, it was a function of an audit. And and we'll hear from Ms. Pallava, but so you know, without getting into all of the back and forth of that particular negotiation that they had with the Department of Revenue, I agreed with the view of the school that it seemed apparent that these materials were captured by the law as is written today. Department of Revenue disagreed. Department of Revenue prevailed, and so our next course of action is to take this step, propose this bill to make it very clear what is deemed instructional material essential to the completion of a course of study. Now, of course, things like paper, pencils, you know, things that everyone needs for, you know, general use in life wouldn't be subject to the sales tax exemption. But things that are specific to a particular course of study, particularly as relates to tools and other materials that relate to a trade, would be exempt.
Senator Dimmel, as I understand it, you're proposing that Senate File 103 is a clarification of what the law means, but that the Department of Revenue interpreted current law differently. And so this bill is not, in a sense, proposing anything new. It's just how your witness and maybe other institutions had been, the understanding of the law that they had been operating under. Would that be an accurate representation?
That is, you said it better than I did, Madam Chair. And just by way of a little bit of evidence, so what I handed out that has my name in the upper right-hand corner is a revenue note from 2001.
You went way back.
Yeah. Well, I won't take credit for excellent sleuthing. This is a function of some sleuthing that a tax analyst in the other body did. Mm-hmm. And she found this. Her recollection is the same as ours. And so when she went hunting for the evidence, she's doing more kind of forensic investigation to try to gain some better insight into the original intent. But she found this. This just came up yesterday. And so if you look under explanation of the bill, proposed law paragraph.
And did we pass this?
Yes. Proposed law. And we passed it without any change to the language. What changed seems to be the Department of Revenue's interpretation of the language. But at some point, they had interpreted the language to include art supplies, mm-hmm. et cetera. I'll also call your attention to the letter that I handed out dated August 18th. I did this just to not to micromanage or interfere in the negotiation, but just to lend
support. And
we're
just going to put your – I know it's from you, but we're going to put your name on top of it.
Well, I didn't write my name because my name is printed on top.
Yes, so we're doing that for our records.
And I'm
– Okay, go ahead.
Making verbal – taking oral ownership of this. So if you look down at the little offset language at the bottom of the first page that's in a different typeface instruction materials, that's taken right from written guidance that the Department of Revenue itself has issued. Instruction materials other than textbooks required, I think the emphasis is mine, to be used directly in the completion of a course of study by students, et cetera, including for-profit schools, and then some examples. Those examples are not exclusive of other sorts of the qualifiers required to be used directly in the completion of a course of study. So Centerpoint School relied on this written guidance as well as phone calls to the Department of Revenue, which they were assured they did not have to be collecting these sales taxes. Apparently there's some sort of course correction later, you know, upon the audit, and then they entered the negotiation that they came out on the short end of. So that's my proposal, Madam Chair. We do have a revenue estimate. The current revenue estimate is somewhat higher than the initial revenue estimate. Maybe that's attributable to the increase in population. I'm not sure exactly.
Madam Chair.
Just a second. If Senator Dibble is finished, then I'll call you.
So I'm finished. Yeah, I was just going to call everyone's attention to the revenue estimate. It's a preliminary, apparently. I'm not sure what makes it to be preliminary. I do understand Department of Revenue wants to tighten the language.
Well, it's preliminary because it's drawn to the bill as introduced rather than what might be amended, I assume.
All right.
We're going to hear from Mr. Cummings again, but Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, first of all, I love the sleuthing that went about to find the original intent. And I want some clarification related to that. I was looking at that 2001 fiscal note where it explained the current law. It said these items which were sold to students by educational institutions are exempt. So the bill that you're presenting, is it just sold through the institutions that are selling the other things, or does that mean if they go to Target and they buy pencils and if they, you know, that's what the clarification I'm looking for here.
Oh, that's a good question.
Like under what circumstances
would
they be exempt, used for the educational purpose? If somebody went to Borders or the drugstore and bought materials, is that different than buying them at the school? Is that the
correct.
And that will be the focus of our question about the bill, because it does need
Madam Chair,
to be auditable transactions.
Right. So Madam Chair, I can just speak. I don't know the answer to the question. I don't see a reference to the materials being sold by the school in the language that in front of us. That was my assumption only because that is a circumstance in which CenterPoint, became subject to this particular issue. Mm-hmm. I don't know how exactly a student would skirt sales tax if they went to Borders. I mean, I know that nonprofits can present their taxpayer ID number and avoid sales tax when they purchase at some
because of the knocking, you're going to really have to use your outside voice.
Yeah. So, Madam Chair, I don't know. The short version of the answer is I don't know the answer.
We do need to, right. Senator Dibble, we do need to find that out. I know that, you know.
Certificate.
Big pardon?
Individual opinion and certificate, too. You can ask Ms. Pollack.
Ms. Pollack, do you have any advice for us in trying to understand this?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that regardless of the place where the materials are purchased, if they are taxable or tax-exempt, that would apply no matter what the retailer was. So it would be possible for someone to obtain a certificate of exemption, for example, to present at Borders or to apply for a refund, I suppose, for sales tax paid on a textbook. So right by
so they so Ms. Pollack they could get the tax exempt number from the from the institution in question and going to another place another retailer or to going to a retailer and purchasing the items present that exemption and buy the materials if they are to be tax exempt without paying the sales tax. Is that
Madam Chair, correct? Yes.
Okay. Well, so there's a way. It's a cumbersome, but there's a way. questions for Senator Dibble before we go to his testifier, and then we'll also ask Mr. Cummins after she testifies to speak. So Ms. Palava, is it?
Yes.
If you would identify yourself, please, for the record. And it would be helpful if you would really direct your comments toward the policy and the bill, even apart from your experience with the department, because what we're really interested in is making sure that we understand the effect on you of the policy that is being proposed as a clarification of current law.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Carrie Johnson Palava, co-owner and director of CenterPoint Massage and Shiatsu Therapy School and Clinic in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. I am in support of this amendment due to the experience that I had with the Department of Revenue and the issue of the interpretation of instructional materials. As a company and an accredited institution, we have been very vigilant to stay current with all regulations and pay all appropriate taxes and fees. We're very careful to stay current with the policies and to inquire with the Department of Revenue when there is a question. Just very briefly, yes, we did go through a sales tax audit in December of 2012, and we confirmed our telephone calls. We had documentation of our telephone calls to the Department of Revenue, and we were told in many instances for the required equipment and supplies needed for a student to complete a massage or shiatsu therapy program, that the equipment and supplies were exempt from sales tax. However, during the audit, we were specifically told that the exemption applies to only written textbooks and manuals or the electronic equivalent of textbooks and manuals. We were using the fact sheet 111 for schools and sales and purchases that Senator Dibble quoted. So as a result, we had to pay years of back taxes that we were unable to collect, and we were willing to collect all required taxes sales tax on materials for our students, but we had to pay the back taxes. It's the interpretation of instructional materials that seems to have changed over the years. The written statute seems clear, but the interpretation has changed, and I'm very concerned about the current interpretation. Vocational education plays a very important role in our state and country. Vocational education teaches skills to students who are then very employable after the completion of a program. My massage school is considered vocational education. We have a 93% placement rate, which is extremely high. Vocational education is not just academics, even though textbooks and manuals are part of our required materials. We teach skills, and in order to teach skills, students need to purchase equipment and supplies. Our students need to practice 3 to 4 bodywork sessions every week from day one that they enter the school. They are required to purchase a massage table or a shiatsu mat, lotions and linens at the beginning of their education. They cannot practice their skills without the equipment. We teach the sciences in a kinesthetic model. We are a kinesthetic profession. We use our students built the human musculature out of clay on a skeletal model. This teaches the layering of the muscular system, which muscles are deep and intrinsic and which are superficial. And if anyone on the committee has ever had a massage, you will want your therapist to know the difference. We also teach shiatsu, a form of therapeutic bodywork from Japan. Shiatsu is based on the same foundational principles as acupuncture. Our students are required to purchase a 24-inch model, a human model of a person with the map of the acupuncture points, so they can learn the location of over 700 points on the human body. All of the equipment and supplies needed to learn massage and shiatsu, which I have just mentioned, are currently taxable. Our students must pay sales tax on equipment and supplies. I therefore find a bias in the current interpretation of the instructional materials to favor academia and to discriminate against vocational education. Yes, we use textbooks, and those are exempt, and they're very important. But in many vocational training programs, students are required to purchase equipment and supplies because they're required to practice their skills outside of the classroom in order to develop their skills during their educational process. They do not learn skills from a book. They practice their skills as they go through their education. Skill development is essential and cannot be done without equipment and supplies and regular practice outside of the classroom. So why do students currently enrolled in a course of study that trains them for future employment need to pay sales tax on the required equipment and supplies needed to complete a course of study? This seems unfair and out of line with Minnesota's intent to support education. It's unfair to the student who chooses vocational education over those who choose an academic education. So I ask you to support the amendment submitted by Senator Dibble, SF-103.
Thank you, Ms. Palama. Is there a comment or questions for the witness? Mr. Cummings, does the department have a comment to make? Mr. Cummings, you need to re-identify yourself.
Madam Chair, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. First, I wanted to apologize to Senator Dibble. It was not my intention to testify today, but I do thank the committee for the opportunity to respond. I think there are multiple issues here that I wanted to talk about briefly and move on. I think the first issue is just making sure that the department is giving out quality and accurate advice. At this time, we want to ensure that every phone call that is received, we're giving taxpayers accurate advice. At this time, we don't have a recording of any phone conversations during that time, and we're working to try and think through ways in which we can look back at phone calls and make sure that we have a log. So that's something we're looking into in terms of how we can best do that. In terms of what is our interpretation, it has been our longstanding interpretation that these types of materials are not included in instructional materials. And I think Senator Dibble's handout is actually very helpful to the committee, the revenue estimate from 2001. As part of the revenue estimate from 2001, it includes items like art supplies. So if you look back in the bill, Senate File 1913, it says right in the bill, including art supplies. And by the time it got from committee into the time it got into the final bill, that was something that was deemed by the committee to be taken out. So there is a difference from the bill as introduced to the bill that is finally enacted. So as the department was trying to figure out how to think about how to implement this law and how to construe the bill, it was thought that these types of purchases is something that should be it should be narrowly construed. The Senate and the House took a narrower view than they did originally. So art supplies was originally included, and now it's not.
So, Mr. Cummings, are you saying in the conference committee report that was adopted by the legislature that the term art supplies was not included?
Well, that's right, Madam Chair. I don't, obviously, I was not here in 2001, but I can tell you that the bill is introduced in the bill that this revenue estimate was pegged to did include art supplies. And while art supplies is not representative of some of the other types of materials that have been brought forth today, it is an indication of how this should be, how this exemption should be construed. It really did, as the testifier mentioned, it really did focus on the types of things that are textbooks or text type books, if we're talking about CDs, tapes, computer software, and the like. As it relates to the policy under the exemption currently, you know, that is talked about in this bill outside of the department's administrative actions on this, we think that we want to continue to work with Senator Dibble and the committee to make sure that we can work to have these exempt at the school to make sure that that is done. Ms. Pollack brought up a good point that we could get to a point in instructional materials may mean lumber bought at Home Depot, and you bring in an ST3 and you can get that done, which is, I think, different than the case of what the testifier is bringing up. She's really talking about things that are used in the course of study at her institution, yes, rather than things that could be bought anywhere. And when we get to a Target or a Home Depot, it's very hard for them to distinguish an ST3 that is brought forward in a valid fashion and an ST3 forward brought forward in a different sort of way. So I think that that would be one thing, and we would just want to make sure that the exemption that is written is clear, and we make sure that there are clear lines in terms of what is exempt and what is taxable. With that, Madam Chair, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Cummings. We will pursue that language a little bit more. But Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll do a little bit more checking, but based on my conversation with staff from the other body, I have a different understanding of what Mr. Cullen said. I'll make sure that there's clarification.
Sure.
More clarification. I'll provide that to you, and you can provide that to your committee members.
Senator Dibble, you might ask Ms. McQuay to have a conversation with the House fiscal analyst too.
I will do that. Yeah. And she's doing more checking, so she's not yet completed her efforts. I'll just say parenthetically, and I don't want to get into the history of what happened, but I'm glad to hear that some of the administrative processes and procedures are being looked at by the Department of Revenue. Those are some very, very serious concerns and maybe the subject of a subsequent bill that I introduce, because, frankly, they misled the taxpayer in this instance and then provided no caveat upon having given misled them that their advice could not be then counted upon in a future investigation. So that is very troubling how the Department of Revenue treated this particular.
Paper trails are very, very important, not only for the taxpayer but also for the department. And that's true for other departments as well, in which they are providing a service to the public and to the taxpayers. That level of trust is always better backed up with a paper trail or a recording or whatever.
Or, Madam Chair, even saying, I'm telling you this, but you can't take it to the bank. I mean, but no such caveat was provided at the point at which they sought advice and counsel from the department itself, which was a surprise and disappointing to them.
Anything further, Senator Dibble, before we lay your bill over?
No, I just wanted to respond to, I actually have no issue if lumber needs to be bought in the completion of a course of study, for that being tax exempt. So I think we have some discussion to have about what should or shouldn't qualify for the tax exemption.
Okay. Anything further from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Eaton moves that Senate file 103 be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Dibble, Ms. Palava, Mr. Cummings.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senate file 678, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Ingebrigtsen, is the bill how you want us to consider it, or do you have any changes in it?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing the bill this morning, Senate File 678. No, at this time, unless my two testifiers have some issues with it, it is in its form as of right now, but basically.
Then, Senator Ingebrigtsen, then please proceed.
Okay, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, the sales tax exemption for building materials for resorts and recreational camping areas. Of course, you've heard myself and maybe several others over the years talk about the tradition of camping and resorting in the state of Minnesota and what a tremendous opportunity it is for families to come out and enjoy the beautiful recreation and the beautiful resources that we have. And when I first came here 9 years ago, I represent right now actually over 10% of the lakes in the state of Minnesota, which consequently turns out to be a lot of resorts. And so they're near and dear to me, actually within a mile or two of me on Lake Ida. I have a couple of resorts. But I do see them dwindling, and that was one of the astounding things in my first years was that the amount of resorts where we used to be and where we are now, back in the 60s and 70s, we have numbers that show that there were upwards of, I guess there's some numbers that are not exact numbers, but around 2,500 resorts in the state of Minnesota. And now we're looking at a number of approximately 810 resorts. So this thing that Minnesota has known for eons, if you will, is basically going away for whatever reasons, whether they be financial or people are retiring, and it's becoming cost prohibitive to be in the business. It is happening. So the bill that's before you today is to at least help those that are still in the business of resorts that want to expand on the existing platforms that they have by remodeling and purchasing. In doing improvements to the cabins located on the property or any other structures available for guests of a resort or camping area, actually a sales tax exemption on those materials that are actually taxed. So I think it's a pretty straightforward bill. I do have two gentlemen with me to testify today. As far as fiscal note, I think staff has one that's changed. Joel Carlson will testify about the difference between a couple of years ago when this bill was brought forward as compared to today, showing the difference of what there have been some reductions. So if, Madam Chair, if it's okay, I'd have, I'm not sure exactly which one would like to go first. Joel could go first, and then Dan.
Senator Engelbrechtson, let's see if there are any questions or comments from the members first about the language of the bill itself. Seeing none, who's going to go first?
I'll go first, Madam Chair.
Mr. Carlson, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson, and I'm here on behalf of a group I've long had the pleasure of representing, the Congress of Minnesota Resorts. And the Congress of Minnesota Resorts is an association of family-owned resort operations in Minnesota. I would say of their membership, like 99% of them live at their resort. They live on their lakefront. And resorts, as you know, and as Senator Engelbrechtson mentioned, resorts are the gateway for thousands of Minnesotans to enjoy our outstanding natural resources. And it is a wonderful thing that family memory of a family vacation on a good fishing lake is really part of our fabric in Minnesota, and it is truly an important part of our legacy. But it is an industry that's in decline, and the decline is easy to see. And the reason that it's easy to see is because we've gotten to a situation where the value of your business is become lower than the value of your land. And when you cannot make a going concern business on a 12 or 13 week season, it is very difficult to stay in business, but you have a very valuable asset. And when those resorts get sold, they never come back. And when they're sold off for private development, that just dwindles the opportunity for more Minnesotans to enjoy our outstanding resources. Now, we've long viewed this bill to have a sales tax exemption on their construction equipment as a capital improvement exemption, like this committee has dealt with dozens of times in the past. But we also think that this exemption generates revenue for the state. When we're able to rent that cabin out after we've improved it at a higher rate, all of those lodging bookings come with the state sales tax attached to it. And so it has a direct impact on the revenue that we generate from the resort. But we also know from studies that have been done by Explore Minnesota Tourism that every dollar spent on lodging has a spin-off effect in the local economy of $1 spent on lodging has a spin-off effect of about $4 of local spending. So you're also generating an important local economic impact from these local tourism businesses. And just a brief little commercial about tourism. It is about a $13 billion industry in Minnesota. It employs over 250,000 Minnesotans. It generates over 17% of all sales tax generated in the state. It is an important part of our economic engine in the state. Senator Engelbrechtson mentioned that I wanted to talk a little bit about the fiscal note, and I do. And Senator Resta, I do appreciate the paper trail. And I have my fiscal note from this bill when we first heard it on February 27th in 2001. And at that time,
banner year, as it were. Right?
At that time, there were, according to the fiscal note, 1,125 resorts in Minnesota. If you see the fiscal note in front of you today, there are 800. We are losing about 20 to 25 resorts a year, and that is the decline that we are seeing. And so this bill is an opportunity for resorters to have some additional incentive to invest in their properties. And as to changing the bill, Senator, in the past it applied to just construction at your resort. The current bill deals with improvements to existing structures, and we think that's very helpful. I think you could look at this as the construction that goes on at a resort, whether you're building a reunion cabin or you're tearing down a cabin and rebuilding. You passed a law in 2009 that allows resorts to take down a cabin and rebuild on its existing footprint, and that was a big help for resorts. I wonder if the language is a little so tight that it wouldn't maybe include those types of constructions that are going on, but it is truly a step in the right direction. We would urge your favorable consideration of it, and that is our capital. Our cabins are our capital, and we would appreciate you favorably considering this. And it's just like when we buy an outboard motor and we rent it out every time, we don't pay the sales tax on the outboard motor. But we pay the sales tax every time we rent it. We view the cabins as very similar. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, any questions? Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, first of all, be it noted that we both agree today.
We're going to put that in the Senate Journal.
Any data on how much rates go up after a remodeling project? You know we can't do dynamic scoring, but at least I want to have some sense of, because that does increase the sales tax we collect.
It does, and I know Representative McElroy's got some information he wants to share in that capacity as well. But we do know that that rates can go up dramatically because people want more amenities. They want larger space. They want these reunion cabins that I mentioned are something people really are interested in, where you can bring a family of four or six families together in one location, and that has a dramatic impact on the rates that you're able to charge. I can't tell you that it goes up 10% or 12%. It's maybe a knowable number, and I'll look to try and get that.
And, Madam Chair, before Mr. McElroy makes a comment, just one more question to any of the testifiers. I've been told that the Gull Lake chain far exceeds in beauty and value the Alexandria Lakes chain. Is assuming that's correct.
Madam Chair, I've been here 35 years. I know enough not to touch that question.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Senator Gazelka should really look for somebody to get better information from. I'm not sure where he's getting it, but he needs. I'll help him out with that, Madam Chair.
Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to any one of you who can answer this question, I was wondering about people who own their own homes or cabins on lakes but rent them out online. How does this affect that?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, the increase in popularity of vacation home rentals is a concern for the industry, and it's a concern for local regulators, and we've had issues at the state. I would say that this bill wouldn't impact that because very few of those vacation home rentals are licensed as a resort as is required by the bill. And so there are some that have actually, some vacation rentals, and I give them credit, they have actually taken the step to get a license from the Department of Health to operate. To do that, they have to have appropriate zoning, and that's what prevents many of them from getting licensed. But even at that, they don't have a resort license, so they wouldn't be impacted by the bill.
Anyone else? Mr. McElroy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dan McElroy. I represent the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. We have many of the same or similar members to the group that Joel to the Congress. We also represent some of the larger resorts and a fair number of campgrounds. We have about 340 members. A third are purely resorts, a third are purely campgrounds, and a third have both kinds of facilities. I want to thank Senator Ingebrigtsen for carrying this bill. It was drafted narrowly to limit the fiscal impact and to concentrate on improving existing facilities, because we're hearing from our members that our guests are looking for modern facilities with more bedrooms, up-to-date bathrooms, modern kitchens, air conditioning, and other features that older cabins and lodge rooms may not have, both because we're competing with other kinds of vacations and we're competing with resorts in other states, including South Dakota, where the tax situation is quite different, in Wisconsin, Upper Michigan, and upstate New York, where there has been more investment. I did ask my members what impact a renovation has, particularly when they add features like ceramic tile bathrooms or modern air conditioning. And the answer was between $200 and $400 a week on a typical cabin. Cabins range in rentals from $700 or $800 a week to $3,000 and $4,000 a week, depending on how many bedrooms and how many amenities they may have. And I know we don't do dynamic scoring on bills like this, but I did a fairly simple model with a 7.25% sales tax on the building materials and on the increase in rate, and the payback to the state is less than 3 years. It is a good investment, but the real investment is in maintaining. At a typical resort, 12 to 15 families will use a cabin in a year, where if we lose it from resort status to private status, only one family usually gets a chance to enjoy it. Representative Gazelka mentioned the number as to where we started. We think this may have been higher at one point, but in 1975, the U of M Agricultural Extension Service did a study of the number in 1970, and there were 2,527 Minnesota resorts, and 32 lodging properties described as other, which we think were motor courts or the like that may be resort-like. And as the fiscal note indicates, that's declined to 810. We lost that I know of, and Joel and I have compared notes a little bit, a number of resorts between 2014 season that won't reopen as resorts in 15 because they've been bought as family compounds or split up into cottages. If resorts can be more competitive, which this bill allows, we believe we can slow that trend at least somewhat, Madam Chair. So our members are very supportive of this bill.
Any comments for Mr. McElroy or for the author? Thank you very much, then, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Dietzick moves that Senate file. Is it?
678.
678 be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much for bringing the bill to us, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Members have before them the minutes from February 18th, 2015. Are there any corrections to be made? Seeing none, Senator Dietzick moves that the minutes from February 18th, 2015 be approved as presented. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The next bill and final bill for today is Senate File 532. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 532 offers also deals with sales tax and proposes to offer an exemption for materials that are used in public projects, school districts, local governments of any sort, that is currently not available to them without a great deal of red tape if the materials are purchased by a contractor that is working with a local government entity rather than directly by the local government or the government itself. And this bill is an attempt to break through that red tape while being attentive to the issues of not providing wiggle room for a contractor to purchase materials, equipment, whatever, not materials, I guess, it's materials, not equipment, materials to be used in a local government project that then the overage could been materials bought exempt, and then later, if all those materials were not used in that project, to be used in a project that otherwise, if they had been purchased for that project, would not be tax exempt. That's been one of the major issues from the department, and I've been very sympathetic to that. and this bill is attempting to find a way that we can deal with the substance of the issue, that is, that materials purchased by a local government are tax exempt for their construction projects, rather than the form. How do we get around the form and deal with the substance? So 532 then is our approach to allowing that to happen, and the bill was brought to me by local governments, and it is supported by the League of Cities and counties and so forth. So I'm going to ask the chair to call on the witnesses to provide the background, and I understand there is an amendment. Is that correct?
Senator Rest, there's the A2 amendment, and it's in the folders for the members.
Mr. Chairman, I move the A2 amendment, which is technical in nature.
Is this an author's
amendment? It's an author's amendment. This is a first stop.
Members will vote on Senator Rest's motion to adopt the A2 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. To either one of the testifiers, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Wayne Houlin. I'm the interim public works director and city engineer for the city of Crystal. I've also served over 17 years with another community as their public works director and city engineer. And I want to thank you for taking this opportunity to talk to you today. The city of Crystal is a fully developed suburb with a population of about 23,000 people, located just northwest of Minneapolis. I'm here to support the Senate File 532, which will help streamline the way that exempt entities can claim the sales tax exemption on construction materials. The city of Crystal spends an average of $4.6 million on capital street improvement projects every year. These projects are bid out to general contractors that provide both labor and materials for these projects. The city balanced the savings of claiming the exemption against all the costs imposed by claiming it and decided it made more sense to not claim the exemption. For instance, to separate the material and labor for these projects is very difficult, since most of the projects are bid out on a per-unit basis, meaning that you purchase so many lineal feet of curb and gutter to be placed on a project, or so many tons of asphalt to be placed within the roadway itself. To purchase materials separately presents logistic issues, such as timely delivery of materials to the job site, storage of materials, what do you do when you need additional materials, or if you've overbought the materials, or if you have warranty issues of having one supplier and one person place in the, or one entity place in the product itself. A couple of construction projects that the City of Crystal has been involved with adds up to approximately $500,000 in sales tax or sales tax on the construction materials. One was a neighborhood roadway reconstruction project that had a total cost, construction cost of $5 million, with about $185,000 of that would have been sales tax. The other is a current public works building construction project that has a total cost of $7.8 million, with a little bit over $300,000 of sales tax. If you took that $500,000 on that sales tax and applied it towards a typical roadway maintenance program for Crystal, you could extend their maintenance program by 3 miles per year. I believe that this bill is very important to streamlining the ability to recoup the sales tax paid for on material costs, and will benefit not only the residents of Crystal, but all the people that we work for. Thank you again for giving me the opportunity to tell our story.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee? All right, thank you. Go ahead, identify yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patrick Hines. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Senator Rest for authoring this bill on our behalf. And I'll note that there are a number of other organizations who support the bill, including the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Township Association, the School Boards Association, the Municipal Utility Association, and Metro Cities. And I'll be brief about why we need this. As Senator Rest noted, under current law, if a city or other exempt entity purchased construction materials for a public project, they're exempt. The one exception is if those materials are purchased as part of a lump sum contract, and that's really the type of contract that is used on most every construction project that a city or other exempt entity is going to undertake. And so in order to meet the requirements that are imposed by rules of Department of Revenue, cities have to go through a very complicated process, which was alluded to by Mr. Houle. You have to separately bid out labor and materials, which causes a lot of hassle in administering a project. You have to award different bids for those materials and labor. You can have many more contractors on a project than you ordinarily would because of that. In addition, you have to designate your contractor as a purchasing agent of the city in order to claim the exemption, and that requires that the city itself take on the risk of loss and the liability for materials. So any defects or damages or delays of materials is now the responsibility of the city as opposed to the general contractor. This can create a lot of problems if there's litigation over a project that went wrong. And as Mr. Houle said, when cities balance the cost that they can save by claiming the exemption with all the other costs imposed by the rules, many cities find that it simply doesn't make sense to claim the exemption. And so what this bill does is it doesn't claim an upfront exemption. It allows cities to the contractor would pay for the materials and pay the tax up front. The contractor would then provide documentation for the city so that it could apply for a refund. This is an existing process that Revenue currently uses, so we're not recreating the wheel here. And we think this is a good compromise. It will allow cities to claim the exemption without having to change all of their contracting practices, and it still gives Revenue the information it needs to properly oversee and make sure that contractors aren't improperly claiming the exemption. So with that, I appreciate your time today, and I'll stand for any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hines. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would note that unlike the previous three bills, this bill does have a hefty price tag. And I would point out that I don't know for certain, but just intuitively, I believe that comes because of the impact, not on the city, quite frankly, but on school districts that are constantly, usually have more than one building. They are constantly doing upgrades on and rehabbing the bills that they do have, buildings that they do have, and those projects. And I don't know. I don't think it's split out as I read through it quickly, but I think that might be where we're seeing the biggest impact. And I do think that it is, again, and speaks to the substance of the law that we passed before, keeping in mind, since we've been doing a little history here, it goes beyond 2001, where previous to that, prior to that, local governments were not subject to the sales tax. And then in a budget crunch, we offered imposing the sales tax as a alternative to a drastic reduction in LGA, as I recall. And we offered that, and they took the sales tax imposition because at the time they felt like there was more, they had more control over purchases than otherwise. And we know that in the long run that just really isn't the case. If you need to buy a stove, finally you buy the stove. And so that there isn't as much control over those kinds of things as we sometimes like to tell ourselves in what on the face of it seems to be a voluntary tax environment. So Mr. Chairman and members, that's our story. We're trying to speak to the substance of the current exemption and to be respectful of the department and providing a more streamlined process for this exemption for construction materials and projects that are being put forward by them, by local governments, to make sure they have the same exemption as if in the form of a refund, but that the local governments would have if they were making the purchases themselves. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't have anything further.
Okay. I should ask if there's anybody else that would care to testify on the bill. Welcome, Mr. Carlson, and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the greater Minnesota counties and regional centers and 4 of the ring counties here in the metropolitan area. And I want to thank Senator Ress for introducing this bill. We do support the legislation, most importantly because of the effects that it would have on our highway and road construction projects. As has been discussed here, in order to purchase those materials that are used for those projects tax-exempt, you have to go through a complicated process of splitting contracts into two, and most importantly, assuming the liability for the suitability of those materials and any future liabilities relating to whether those materials perform or not. And quite frankly, counties don't want to get into that sort of issue. As you can well imagine, when issues come up, when materials fail, there's always a debate, frankly, litigation between the contractor who installed the materials and the manufacturer of the or supplier of those materials. We don't want to get in between that. If this bill passes, we would simply have the ability to go after the performance bond or the insurance of the general contractor, and it's up to him or her to resolve the issue with his or her supplier. So we very much support this legislation and would welcome its enactment. Then I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you. Anything further, Senator Ress?
No, Mr. Chairman, then I would move that Senate File 532 is amended. Or is somebody coming up?
I guess we do. Senator Ress.
Oh, Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I just wanted to say briefly that this concept and bill has taken a long road. And I wanted to thank Senator Rest and the League of Minnesota Cities, specifically Gary Carlson and Patrick Hines, for continuing a dialogue to make sure that we're creating the best product for taxpayers, for cities, for people who would use this. So I really appreciate your thoughtful leadership on this. And again, this is if this gets part of the final package, we think that it's really close to the strike zone. We're looking at the amendment, and if there's any feedback, I'm sure it would be technical. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay. Nothing further from the committee. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 532, as amended, be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Senator Rest. And all in favor of Senator Rest's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank
then
you, Senator
Rest. Mr. Chairman, I believe there's no further business before the committee. We are meeting tomorrow at 8:30, and I would invite you to adjourn the meeting.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Rest, for bringing the bill forward, and we're adjourned.